So when we think about comedy, we think about punchlines and charisma, and my guest today has got both. But I guess a better question is, what does stand-up teach us about reading a room in seconds, or making new friends, or keeping ideas and ditching ideas? Today, my guest is my good friend Hassan Ghali, comic, writer, cultural interpreter, and many more besides. And we are mining the world of stand-up for lessons that you can use on Monday morning. Hassan, how you doing, brother?
I'm not bad. How are you?
I'm really good. No, thank you for being here. I'm really excited about this one. So as we often do, we are going to start with Winner Stays On, comic edition, comics in their prime. You ready to go?
Well, let's see.
All right, man, here we go. Lenny Bruce versus Richard Pryor.
Richard Pryor.
Richard Pryor versus George Carlin.
George Carlin.
George Carlin versus Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy any day.
Eddie Murphy versus Joan Rivers.
Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy versus Jerry Seinfeld.
Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy versus Chris Rock.
Ooh.
That's a tough one, to be fair.
Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy versus Robin Williams.
Oh, these are my two favorite. Robin Williams and Eddie Murphy. I think it'll have to be a tie.
All right, well, let's pick one of them.
Robin Williams.
Robin Williams versus Dave Chappelle.
Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, Dave Chappelle versus Bill Burr.
Dave Chappelle.
Dave Chappelle versus Ali Wong.
Dave Chappelle.
The GOAT, Dave Chappelle, in your opinion, in my opinion, it is Richard Pryor. That is for our regular listeners who know we do the reverse Turing test to prove that we are human. We are not, in fact, AIs. I think 79's Richard Pryor set is the best comic set I've ever seen. And I still watch it. Like, if I'm in a bad mood, I'll sit. And that's the beauty of comedy, right? Is that you can be in a bad place and you watch Delirious, Eddie Murphy Delirious, and everything seems right again, doesn't it? Hassan, for those who are living under a rock and don't know who you are, why don't you just spend a couple of minutes introducing yourself?
So I'm Hassan Jedi. I'm a Sudanese, British. I used to be a doctor. I used to be a urologist. And then I made a career shift into public policy and economics. And then I decided that, you know what, I need to be true to myself and do the thing that I enjoy most, which is comedy. And I've been doing comedy for a few years. I still consider myself in my nascent phase, but we're there and we're going. We're pushing. So now I'm a comedian based between Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and between London, where you're performing here and there and everywhere. So pretty much that's me.
What was the spark, or what was the guy who pushed you, or the mentor, or the thing that pushed you to go on stage?
I think there was a lot of factors that pushed me on to going onto stage, because, you know, since I was in school, I was always labeled the class clown, where, you know, the moment you have a teacher who's not there and they'll be like, okay, there's no one, go to the front and just do impressions of the teacher, do impressions of people in class, do impressions of the principal. And I got into a lot of trouble for that. You know, I got into a lot of trouble for that. And I think, also, when I was in medical school, you know, I had the same thing where, you know, I would set up my own small, let's say, stand-up gigs or sets. And that sort of continued on during my career and during work and everything. I remember when I was working in urology in Newcastle, people would wait on the Friday afternoon. We had a theater, but everybody would come to the registrar's office. And it would be pretty much the funniest place anyone would. People actually come in and just hang out over there. So I got to a stage where, you know, people are like, oh, why don't you do stand up? Why don't you do stand up? And it's one of those things which is scary. You're like, I'm not sure I can go on stage. And you study it and you watch it and you do all that. But then I got a gift. I was trying to join it's a birthday gift to join a comedy course in London. Where I said, okay, I'll do it. So the first time round, I only did two lessons and then I couldn't finish the rest. And I came back about, I think, a year or 2 years later and I finished it. And that's how I started doing comedy. And that comedy ended with a showcase where it was my first comedy performance on stage. But again, I have done some stuff online and some voiceovers during the Sudanese revolution and all that. And some of it actually got a lot of traction. Some people didn't know it was me, but that was the first time I got on the stage.
When you did that comedy showcase, do you remember it? Do you remember like what worked, what didn't work, what died, what lived?
Yeah. I remember it very well because pretty much it was a really good set, actually, to be honest. It was a really good set. I remember coming up onto stage and, you know, you get to learn. The first thing you do in comedy is it's a conversation. You introduce yourself. You know, you don't come up to someone and say, hey, let me tell you a joke. So I, the first thing I remember saying is I'm Sudanese, which means I'm on the MI6 watch list. And then everyone just started laughing. My first introduction, I'm the top applicant for an Uber job according to LinkedIn. So, you know, these were sort of stereotypes that you just begin to your introduction.
Love it.
So
you said you used to be a neurologist. I don't think you ever stop being a doctor, right? Once you're a doctor, you're a doctor forever. Like, how has being, I mean, that's such a, it's so weird, right? Because that's like, there's nothing more serious than being a neurologist, right?
And then, a urologist. I always get that. I'm the downstairs one, not the upstairs one.
You're a urologist. My God, is there anything even more serious than being a urologist? Surely that's even more serious for a man, anyway.
Exactly, so, it's for men, yeah.
You know, you've gone from being like a urologist to a successful comedian, even though you say that you're up and coming and what have you, but you are a successful comedian, and people just need to go to your Instagram and look at your sets, and you are hilarious. How, if at all, how did your previous career shape your decision to move into comedy?
I think the thing about comedy, which is, and I think it differentiates, you need to have life experience to be a comedian, and you need to have really like stories and experiences in life. And I think the stuff that you see in hospital and stuff, sometimes it's really sad, but sometimes it's hilarious. Again, hopefully, you know, you don't put patient confidentiality out there, you see some things that you would never imagine people, and like humans are funny, man. Like just being around humans, the stories you see. So being there, I think one of the things that being a hospital doctor is very stressful. Like you have a lot of hours and things, but the way you deal with it is always with laughter. Like I remember being in the hospital and we would always have jokes. I would play practical jokes on other, you know, I'd be a colleague who's on nights. And then you call him pretending to be, I don't know, a Nigerian doctor or something. And, you know, I want to send a patient to you. And the guy would be like taking the patient notes and stuff. Actually, I always remember one of my good friends, he was Scottish, and you know, I would always call up pretending to be him, just to get out of it. Like, hello pal, how you doing? It's me, it's Mo. So I think like the environment within a hospital is so stressful that you actually need these things to lift morale, to get people going. And you learn a lot out of it. And you also learn a lot because you see a lot of people. You see people from different backgrounds. I remember my first set was actually me doing an impression about how different patients react to pain. Pretty much that was just my set. You know, you get Nigerians, they'll be like, you know, the pain that I'm experiencing right now is tantalizing. You know, it's too much. So,
oh my God. I should have known that this was going to happen because we went out for a coffee in Riyadh and I my jaw was hurting for like 2 days afterwards. I'm trying to do a serious podcast. Okay. Right. So
back to point. I was in trouble. Back to seriousness, you know.
Compare your first set to the last set. Where was the last set that you did?
My last set was actually in London. I opened up for a good friend of mine. Comedian name is Ula Labib. She's touring right now. Anybody watching, I definitely recommend you seeing her tour. Ula Labib, She's really a trailblazer in comedy, and she's a really good. She's really a pride of for the Sudanese.
Oh, fantastic!
She's Sudanese. So it was at the Soho Theatre in London, which I think, you know, is a really amazing place to perform. And you know, you sort of get to stay where you know, doing 5 minutes back in the day was like a difficult, and it was, oh my god, do I have enough content? And I have to do 5 or 7 minutes, and you're like, come on, I need more time, because you know, you sort of start to develop a comedy sort of persona. And my persona is storytelling, you know, like going into stories and doing impressions and taking it and then coming back to a punchline, for example. So I think from when I first started, I would say that I'm still learning. I'm always going to still be learning. But the difference now is that you sort of, to a degree, have sort of realized, these are my opinions. This is how I do comedy, rather than just exploring. And you're still doing that. I'm still exploring my sort of comedy persona, let's say.
Do you have a process that you go through to write a joke?
I would like to say yes, but I would be lying. I mean, I think a lot of the time I'm very observant to things that happen, and you see something and then you start imagining one thing after the other. And, you know, sometimes you'll be watching the news, for example, and you just imagine things. Like, to be honest, right now, a lot of my jokes are based on what I watch on the news, especially the US news. And you just imagine, and you just take it to ridiculous places. You know, so again, a lot of it is based on the things that I see day to day. You'd be on the tube, and you'd be like, that guy looks weird. Why is it that people, I don't know, why is it that, for example, on a plane, why is it that the flight attendants, I've never seen a Somali flight attendant. I've never seen a Somali, like, why is it? And then I start making a joke about it. And imagine having a Somali flight. How is it that I've never seen a Jamaican flight attendant? Okay, so you then end up doing jokes about that. I'm like, okay, Sudanese flight attendants, what's so special about them? And then you start putting those bits together. I always start recording it. Like, whenever I have a point or a premise that I would say, you record it and then you put it together. And interestingly, people might think this is crazy. The best time to write a joke is for when I first wake up in the morning. Because sometimes I wake up laughing at something that I just thought, like, I don't know, you know that phase where you're not really awake, I just start laughing, and I just start writing down some of the stuff. And those were some of the best sets that I've ever had. So having a process, yes, I try as much as possible to write regularly, write stuff, but so a lot of time it just comes out of the blue, or observation or inspiration from your environment.
But it sounds like that is your process. It sounds like your process is to be really, really observant and then question the things that people don't typically question. You were just saying that, like, a lot of your jokes at the minute are coming from the US, which is, you know, the US news, which is frankly hilarious in and of itself. But give me an example of something that you saw and then how that developed into an idea or a premise.
Okay, so what did I see recently? Yes, for example, I recently started, like, a few years ago, I tried to do, I was stressed out with COVID, so I started doing therapy. And then I would go through all these different websites and things and see how different people and different therapists react. And then I spoke to an American therapist, I spoke to an Indian therapist, I spoke to an African therapist. African therapist I made up, you know, I just made it up. I had to add it there. And I turned that into a set, because it was part of something I was going through. And for example, you know, I'd see the Indian therapist, and I thought, okay, what, you know, the guy was, you have to do guided meditation. Guided meditation, they're going to do it, okay? And then and I started playing into my own bits. what is the things that you're facing? What are the problems? And I'll be going back to him. And then, like, you start playing, and the thing is, I always like changing around when there's different audience. I never have like, I don't like repeat it. Sometimes you do because, but I feel that was always, that was one. There was another one where it was about Sudanese people being late, and Uber drivers, Sudanese Uber, they're always late, they're always lost. They're always like, where is your location? A location, when? Into when? And, you know, they're always arguing. And so I just turned that into sort of a set that I engaged into something else. So, yeah, there's plenty of different examples of how a story that I saw a patient once in the hospital. So it's always like, you get inspired by something that is unique to you, and then you just turn it to something ridiculous. But you always come back to something that is like, I try to bring it back to a punchline that breaks down these stereotypes, let's say.
I understand. I get it.
So, yeah.
You said before that you don't tend to write stuff down, but sometimes you'll record them. Do you mean, like, you'll record them as a voice memo, or you'll record them, like, as a video, or what?
Yeah, I'd record them as a voice memo, because I realized when I was taking notes, for example, I could literally just open this up right now and say, look, I have a bit here that says pharaohs and people taking selfies. Okay, because I was in Egypt, and I was in the museum. I was looking around, and I found it hilarious that, you know, the pharaohs worked so hard to build the pyramids and so hard to do all this just for some lady to come and say, oh my God, look at this, you know, hashtag blessed, you know? So I just wrote it down here, and I'm like, pharaohs, selfies. It had no sense, because a lot of comedy is about the energy that you bring. And it's about, and so I feel that the energy just goes when you write it down on a piece of paper, because it doesn't make sense. So what I'll do is I'll record it, and I'll record it in the way that I thought about it. I would do the impression. I would do what I found funny. And then you sort of then build on it, just as a voice note, and you come back to it and you're like, actually, I can build on that.
Mm. That makes sense. What percentage of things that you sort of write down, or you do a voice note from, what percentage of that like dies, and what percentage makes it to stage?
90% dies.
90% dies.
Yeah. 90% dies. But funnily, out of that 90%, sometimes you end up using it, because it can come in at a moment where you're like, actually, oh, boom, there was something I sort of discarded, and now it's funny, it's relevant to something that happened within the audience, for example. But it won't be part of your main act, it won't be part of your main set. Because, again, if you're observant, there's a lot of noise that comes in. There's a lot of things that come in. And there's things that they come in, unless you do them now, they're dead. It's very time sensitive, very time specific, very location specific. Like if I make a joke about, I don't know, Sudanese mothers in, I don't know, Chichester, south of England, I don't think anybody is going to find it hilarious. And then sometimes just with time that dies, but then I'll be doing a gig with Sudanese people. I'm like, actually, yeah, you know why mothers, they say this, and you come back. So a lot of it, the majority of it dies. Like if I show you my notepad, this is, you won't be able to see, but I can scroll here for days. Right. And this is all the material premises that I've sort of been putting together. But a lot of it doesn't get to, I don't develop most of it, let's say.
Have you ever had a joke that you thought this is killer, and then when you took it to stage, it just didn't work?
Plenty of times.
Yeah.
Has to happen. Like sometimes I think there's two parts. Comedy is giving, and like you saying what you say, but people also being willing to receive it. Because you could do back-to-back gigs and you do that joke somewhere and it would kill. And you do the exact same joke, different audience, and people will just be like, mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the it's really important to realize that there are no rules to what is going to make people laugh in comedy. That's number one. Number two, it also, it's like a muscle that you develop, that you start to think, well, how can I make this better? Because again, if it doesn't, if you say something 2, 3, 4 times and people don't laugh at it, you know, maybe there is something that I should rewind and like have a look at. And another habit I try to get into is recording my sets and then going back and trying to listen to where people laughed and where they chuckled and where they didn't. Because sometimes the same way you'd say a joke, a lot of comedy is because of surprise, the element of surprise. And sometimes because you've heard the joke so many times yourself, or maybe you thought of it, people have you end up saying it in a way that you've already sort of made it pop before or something, and it just passes over people's heads. Because so I think you learn that, number one, different audiences, there's no rules, you have to build a lot of thick skin. And when you're doing new material, it helps you sort of refine it and make it better. So that's why you have a lot of comedians who's a work in progress. That's why they end up turning up at smaller comedy clubs and trying stuff. And, you know, I've seen some amazing comedians, A-listers, bomb on stage in front of me with new material. And they're like, we don't care, we're trying this out. And one of my comedy mentors said, listen, remember, this is feedback. This is feedback to your joke. It doesn't mean you're a good or a bad comedian. It just means maybe you could have delivered it differently. Maybe it's the energy you brought in. Maybe it was you stopped too early, the punchline, the pauses. These things are really, really important in comedy. So yeah, it happens. It happens to the best of us.
A quick message from this episode's sponsor, Ruya. Road safety isn't more data, it's better outcomes. Ruya's AI cameras flag distractions, fatigue, and harsh driving in real time. Managers get a clear report on and video when it matters. The result? Safer drivers, fewer claims, and lower costs. The link to Ruya is in the show notes. All right, back to the show. The muscle that you kind of referred to before that you build, which is, I guess, in part, it's about reading a room, right? Reading an audience. Does that translate to like one-to-one interactions? When you meet people, do you find that you're able to quickly and easily build a rapport with them?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think that is one of the good things that you learn from medicine, is that because you deal with a lot of people and the different people react, you always end up being able to, you know, if I meet somebody, for example, from Argentina, you know, and I've not been to Argentina, but you try to bring something that you think that you might have in common. You know, you might end up talking about football, you might end up talking about whatever. So you try to bring something that is relevant to, because people like that sort of familiarity when you bring it in. And I think if you're able to do that in comedy, it really shows, I think, also respect to your audience. For example, if I'm in Saudi, I always try to bring in things from our life. You know, things like, you know, how I'd make a joke about the airport, which is specific to Riyadh airport, for example. Or I'll make a specific joke about a specific neighborhood in Riyadh. And to be honest, a lot of the good comedians I've seen, you know, Andrew Schultz and stuff, they always make an effort to research the neighborhood or the culture, the local. And I think that's really what makes a difference. Because you can go somewhere and just say the same thing. It's like, that's not relevant to me. But if you make a joke about, I don't know, your roads are crowded or whatever, you guys have been hanging out in Tahliya, you look like you're from North, but that actually resonates with people. Even if it doesn't get a chuckle, it doesn't need to be the funniest thing in the world, but to a degree it shows that you know something about the region, something about the people, and people stay engaged with you.
It's like building, you're building a kind of like, you're showing mutual respect, right?
In that, absolutely.
You kind of, I've taken the time to try and understand your culture, even if I'm not from it. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I think that goes down well kind of everywhere. But whilst we're talking about Saudi, what are the kind of things that kill in Saudi that don't necessarily translate outside of Saudi?
I'd say Saudi is also multicultural, let's say, but it's a different sort of multiculturalism that you get in Saudi that you get in for example, the UK. You know, in the UK, if you wanted to make jokes about different societies, different, you know, say ethnic minorities, it would be, you know, you do a joke about Southeast Asians, Jamaicans, Caribbeans. In Saudi, it's a bit different. You would make jokes, say, Sudanese, they would get that very well. Egyptians, whatever. So if you're doing it on that front. I think the other thing in Saudi is, you also don't want to alienate your audience by being rude. And also because there is you know, culturally, we are from conservative societies. We value respect. If you go on stage and you disrespect people, you're going to alienate them. In the UK, for example, that's not always necessarily the case. You know, you can get people turn up on stage and say, you are a kitty, whatever. You know, I don't like your hair. What's that? You're getting a haircut. You know, they take the mickey out of you so much, and people still find it funny. So I think Saudi's sort of in a phase where she's a very interesting site where the comedy scene is growing, and it's comedians are sort of building, they're shaping the culture. You know, we're not inheriting anything. You know, in the UK, you're inheriting a culture that is already there. There, you're sort of shaping it. You're shaping what things people find acceptable, what are the things you can joke about, what you can't. So it's an experimental phase. So I think, but what is really important is to do comedy, but also do it in a respectful way and not in a disrespectful way, because you would alienate so many people. Unlike in the UK, Glenn, you might not necessarily.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. Like, I'm trying to think, like, I think of Jack D, for example. Like, he made an entire career out of being grumpy and rude. It just wouldn't work in the GCC in general. It just doesn't
try. All the Arab world. Imagine doing it in Sudan as well.
Yeah, I mean, that just wouldn't work. I mean, that would
end. Do you know who I am? Do you know who you're talking to? Wallahi al-azim. You know? Wallahi, I will not leave you. Wait for me outside the show. You have all these people waiting outside backstage. You'd have Chris Rock. You'd have a Will Smith, Chris Rock every night, you know.
I remember I went to see Dave Chappelle in Abu Dhabi last year, maybe, or the year before. And he danced around that line so well. He danced on that line. I mean, he was right there, and he was like one word away from, but he just, I don't know, it was almost, it was like a ballet. He was dancing around that line so beautifully. Can you learn that, or is that just innate?
I think you learn it. I think it's also, it does, like, you require all types of intelligence. You require verbal intelligence, emotional intelligence, social intelligence, awareness. So, like, everything there is a thin line. And you can make a joke about something that can be seen as a taboo, but not offending anyone. You know, because I think it ends up, because again, you can't control who you offend. My existence is standing up there might offend someone. You know, why is there a black man sitting down talking to us? You know, like, I mean, you might offend somebody just by breathing, but that's not the point. The point is, it's about knowing. And one of the things about comedy is saying things that people think, but they're not willing to sort of, they don't want to say themselves. You know, there's a lot of things, people laugh at it. So I really think that a lot of it is being very aware culturally about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. You know, a lot of comedians end up, I don't know if they do it, but they trial their material with on audiences to see what is acceptable and what is not, what will get laughs, what will not get laughs. And they get a lot of feedback for it. Someone like Dave Chappelle is a genius. You know, he's just a different level of artistic and knowing how to, you know, even linguistically, he's amazing. All his pace, everything is just incredible. But I think if you are to play that line and try to dance around it, you sort of need to, number one, have a lot of thick skin, because it might not work.
As he found out himself.
You know. And but again, you know, I think he says that, you know, you also want to be true to what you stand for. I think that's a really important part in comedy is, you know, you're not just a performer. You're not just somebody who's coming up there and dancing. No, you have an opinion. You have your own moral set that you start. There's certain things I don't like joking about. There's certain things, you know, I see as a red line. I don't go there. But again, if you're wanting to go there, there's risks and there's a cost to it. So, but you need to be true to yourself and true to what you stand for.
How do you deal with, like, an audience which is a mixed audience? I guess, like, because you've done shows in the UAE before as well, haven't you?
Yeah, just a few ones.
So, like, how do you deal with an audience like the UAE, which is generally going to be so mixed, so many different cultures? At least in Saudi, you can kind of guarantee 50-60% of the audience is local, but in the UAE, yeah, you could have like 50 different nationalities in the audience. How do you deal with that?
Look, I think it's one of the reasons I enjoy traveling, is because whenever you travel, you can relate to people. You can relate to different cultures. For example, you know, I did one and there was a South African group at the back. I just ended up doing South African material. Like, I was just improvising there and just doing jokes about, and this was a time where there was a there was the MP who was being sworn in. It was going conscientious. So I started doing things around that. And then, so people, and you need to like appeal to different, because, you know, in the UAE, for example, if you're going to go there, you're going to find Indian society, people from the Filipino background, you're going to find people. So you're going to find that mix of people, you're going to find Lebanese. So you always need to have something at least that is relevant, that also doesn't alienate a specific group. That can, and again, you sort of have jokes where are universal to everyone. You know, if you talk about therapists, I don't know, going to a doctor, airports, these are specific, but then you have specific jokes for specific people, specific jokes for people from, you know, Kenya, specific jokes for people from Nigeria, from Uganda. So I think it's really important, and that you build the muscle by doing that. One of the comedians I really rate a lot and I respect him a lot. So a friend is a guy called Ali Saeed. He's Emirati. He's a mastermind when it comes to just doing crowd work. Like, I saw Ali do 3 hours of crowd work and I could not stop laughing for 3 hours. He came to Sudanese people and he was making fun of us. You know, he was doing Egyptians. He was focusing on the Ukrainians. There was Ukrainians, Egyptians, Sudanese, Lebanese, Indians, Pakistanis, everyone. But he was able to just hit on everyone. And this is, and I think he was a school to learn from. Something like that.
Interesting. Yeah, that's why do you think it is that, because you've also, you know, you kind of worked in public policy, and I don't want to like sound rude, but that sounds really dry. I mean, it sounds like a really, really boring job. Like, how does that even translate? Like, how do you go from like public policy and, you know, structured frameworks and long white papers to making people laugh? Is there any overlap there?
I think there's a lot of overlap there, because I think the issue is that the public, you know, public policy, again, it's a very wide, you know, broad stream. You know, you could do public policy, which is just focusing on macroeconomics and that stuff. And you can do public policy that is about, you know, I don't know, social policy. You can focus on political economy, security, and things that, and like, for example, history. And I think one of the things, again, there is where my take is that people look at the region, and then maybe this is a bit, sorry, people look at the region and they don't understand it, because where are they going to learn? If I want to learn about somewhere, I generally try to see, you know, a comedian. Like, if I go to, you know, to Malaysia, whatever, I'll be like, oh, you know, there's Dr. Lee, he's an amazing comedian from there, or so and so is a comedian. I saw his comedy. A lot of people have learned about South Africa from Trevor Noah, you know? So I think a lot of it then ends up being on the comms part and the representation of the region and the representation of what we have to offer as a culture. And that's where the comedy, because I can write so many papers saying, hey guys, look, we are an amazing place. We are not all terrorists. We are so good. And you want to write, and it's really dry. Nobody's going to read this except for me. And I don't know who else. Like, nobody's going to read that paper. But if you end up doing a skit about it, where you do a comedy sketch where, okay, you know, I did one about, it's about safety, because people always think that the Middle East is, you know, it's war and it's war torn and all that. Then a small skit about a lady who was, you know, an expat living in Dubai and, like, you know, going on TikTok and panicking and, oh my God, it's day one of World War III. I'm worried. I'm going to go back and all this. And she's having, you know, an espresso martini on the beach while she's while she's doing that on TikTok. And she ends up going back to the UK. And the first thing that happens to her is her phone gets nicked.
Yeah.
So, you know, I could have written papers to say, well, you know, the evidence shows that you are unlikely to have, you know, the criminal rates in this country are 24.5% young, but nobody's gonna read that. But you can turn it into a skit, and people will get the idea, they'll get the message. So it's a way of communicating a lot of these ideas, these complex ideas, in a way that is digestible.
God, that's really fascinating to even like look at it like that. Because I'm thinking as you were telling that story, I was thinking back to the Qatar World Cup and all of the videos I saw, not of Brits in at the World Cup, but Brits coming home to the UK and saying, "What are we doing? Why do we live like this?" And those guys over there, they live in they live like that. And actually, when you look at that, that is actually public policy, isn't it? That is what you've really done, is you've delivered a message in a totally different way. It's a fascinating way of looking at things.
Absolutely. Because again, you know, we don't have that many ambassadors to the region. You know, like a lot of people say to me, "Oh, you live in Saudi Arabia? Oh my God." And I'm like, "Nah, man, it's the best place to live." Like I say this to people and people think, and look, you are living in a place that is growing, that is pushing the boundaries of everything. In comedy, not just in policy, not just in, you know, cities, but even in comedy and, you know, where you speak, people are like, "Oh, are you allowed to do it?" I was like, "Man, I have more freedom doing in Saudi than I do in the UK. Mm. You know, we can see what's happening in the United Kingdom. You know, if you're you've got a certain name, a certain background, you're not going to get TV. You're not going to get access. You're not going to get that. But you go to Saudi Arabia, these people, it's based on competence. Are you good enough to do it? Or are you not good enough to do it? You know, that whole thing about, "Oh, there's racism." Look, racism is everywhere. Okay, let's say, I wouldn't say it, but when I look at what's happening in when I see what's happening, it's way less. I don't feel, as you know, as a Sudanese, as a black man living there, that I'm seen as a lower class citizen.
Yes,
and it's all about your competence. Can you do the job? Can you not do the job?
Yeah.
And we've gone away from this. Like, there's a lot of that. And you go to the UK, I could be the best person, but because I have a specific name, because I come from a specific background, or because I speak in a specific way, you're not going to get into these institutions. Yeah. And
I know exactly what you mean. Like, there's this element of covert and overt racism, right? So I always used to say this about Dubai when I first lived in Dubai, which was like early 2001, 2003. They say, Dubai's like what the British would define as racist, but it's really overt. Therefore, it's not racism at all. It's hierarchical. It's more like it's a system. And, you know, it doesn't actually prevent anything. There are no glass ceilings. The head of HSBC is Indian. And so it really doesn't mean anything. Whereas in the UK, it was so subtle and so covert and all behind closed doors. And it's hard to fight an enemy that you can't see and interact with. And I find that a lot more, I find that kind of racism a lot more intrusive, actually, than overt racism.
It's way more toxic.
Yeah.
It's way more toxic because you can get someone joking around, "Ya Zol, Ya Sudan, Ya Zol." But it's actually said out of endearment.
Yeah, it's out of love. They're like,
it's not said out of Ya Khal. It's not actually said out of racism.
No.
Yeah. But I can say somebody there is like, "Oh, I don't see color."
Yes. Really?
Really?
Because I do. Because we all. Yeah, so exactly. It's so strange.
But you don't have any, but I mean, you know.
I just want to go back to stage for a minute. Like back to when you're coming out on stage. I'm so fascinated by this idea because I've never done anything like that. The closest I came to being on stage was being an astronaut in the primary school, in my primary school's nativity play. Really? There were astronauts at the birth of Jesus Christ, apparently. But I'm fascinated about like the. You know, your mindset as you're stepping on stage, right? So if it's a, let's say it's a new location, you've never been at that venue before. How in that first sort of 30 seconds, a minute, what are you trying to do? Are you just going to dive straight into your set? Or are you going to look around and do some crowd work? Are you trying to read the room? What's happening in your mind in those first 30 seconds?
A lot. And, just as a, regardless of how much you do it, it's never going to be normal. Just like I'll come back, but a few weeks ago, I saw one of the most famous comedians in the world perform in London. and he was going off on stage, and I was there with him. I was just walking out of the toilet, not that I'm friends with him or anything, and he just turned out right in front of me. And he was going on stage, and the guy was shaking. And this is a guy who's got more than 6 Netflix specials and something. He's certain, you know, that fear, that anxiety of going up on stage, I don't think it ever goes away. Like, if I saw this guy do it, like, okay, who am I to complain? I was like, you know what? This is normal. But when you go on the stage, I think one of the things that you realize is it depends where you are, for example, in the lineup, if you're opening, if you're at the end. So if you're sort of towards the end, you sort of have an idea of who the audience are, what they said, especially if you were there for, you know, sort of previous comedians. I also try to go to the room beforehand, desensitize myself. I think it's the thing they use in football as well. A lot of footballers end up going into the pitch beforehand to sort of have a look around. But the first few seconds on stage, I think it's always that if they know you, it's easier. You know, if I was Dave Chappelle, you don't need to say anything. You know, you can go and be Bernie Mac. I ain't scared of you. You know, people know who you are. But if you don't know who you are, you need to, number one, command a little bit of respect. You need to show people that they like, get people to think that you're funny, because they're giving you their attention. You need to see, does this person deserve my attention, or should I go back onto my phone and scroll? Mm-hmm. Is this person funny? So you want to do within the first 30 seconds, you want to get a laugh, you want to get people to prove to people that actually, you know, you're worthwhile. Your time is worthwhile coming and watching me. You also try, I can do a little bit, I do some crowd work, but I don't like overdoing crowd work. You know, there's a lot of people who end up, I feel also it's a bit of, I personally don't like it. I don't like people just going on and doing crowd work for 10, 15, 20 minutes. No, but you can say something that is very obvious about the place, something very obvious about the room, something that is happening outside. So something that's relevant to it. You know, for example, if you're in you know, there was a room full of East Africans, and I was like, oh my God, I went in and I was like, oh my God, the last time I saw this many people was in the detention center, the home office detention center. People just started laughing, you know, straight away. You've made an observation and you go back to your introduction then to your set. So, and it depends on a lot of things, you know, the audience, the type, if it's a corporate, if it's not corporate, is it? So, but just always treat it as a conversation. You don't come up onto people and say, I'm going to tell you what I have to say, you know?
Yeah, it makes sense. I want to, in this like last section, then we've got one last section, but in this sort of last section, I want to try and distill a few tidbits for the audience, right? So marketers and startup founders and things out there. I think a lot of the things that you've said there, even though we're talking about policy and comedy, a lot of the things that you've discussed are actually just really relevant in business and in life as well. Like, if you could bottle and sell one sort of skill from your experience as a comedian, what would it be for, like, you know, business owners? What is that thing that would really help them?
So business owners, it's very good, given that most of my business experiences have failed miserably. I'm not sure I'm the best person to give it, but I mean, look, I think comedians, I think one of the things from comedy that you gain, I think I might take two, I think one of them is you're not just up there saying jokes, you're actively listening.
Mm.
You are, and like all senses are on, your eyes, your dance, like everything. So being able to, I think as a comedian, you are able to, you know what people's mood, you know how to adjust your energy. If people's energy is low, you try to bring it back up. So you are sort of, in a way, you're not just saying jokes, you're actively listening. So I think that is something that a lot of business owners don't get. I think people get to stay where they're, oh no, everything is working, that's how we used to do it, we're just going to carry on doing the same playbook and we're going to do it again. No, you can't do that, whether it's with your staff, whether it's with your clients, whether it's, you need to sort of be able to be malleable. And I think that is comedy. And I think you see it best sometimes when you have a tough audience and you see comedians trying to work and you see them at work. I think this is the best time when you see people actively listening and actively working. I think one of the other things that you learn a lot from comedy is generally comedians aren't very good at hierarchy, and we're not very good at it because we don't take ourselves too seriously in the first instance. So I think if you're, and that in itself, I think it helps with the culture that you build as a business owner or somebody who's in the business. Because if you're somebody who's like, no, you can only call me doctor. Don't come into my room unless you've knocked the door 3 times. No. If you're willing to be self-deprecating, you're willing to take a joke, you're willing to like look at failures and say, oh, shit, I made a mistake. You know, it's okay. You know, I think that's probably the things I would say. There's a lot more to say, but I think if I was to focus on things for business owners, I think it would be those two. Active learning and self-deprecation.
Yeah, I think that you've said an awful lot there, which is super valuable. The concept of not just active listening, but active senses, you know, where you're deliberately focusing all of your senses to try and absorb as much information as possible from the people that are in front of you and from the situation. That's huge, I think, for all business owners. And then this concept of humility, just accepting, you know, being humble. And we say having a flat organization, but I don't think you're necessarily talking about having a flat organization in terms of org structures. You're saying treat people with respect and be humble yourself. I think that builds so much trust. And maybe one more that I would add in from something that you said earlier, which is make a real effort to build rapport with people, you know. Take the time to build rapport, because there's a lot of value there. That's awesome. I want to do one last section, right? So one word answers, quick fire questions. Let's see what you got. Okay.
I'm not one a word question person, but let's go.
I'm gonna let you be flexible, man. All right. Setup or punchline?
Setup.
The premise or the persona?
Persona.
The stage or the page?
Stage.
Clubs or theatres?
Clubs.
Is crowd work an art or a crutch?
Crutch.
Risk.
Not always.
risk. Yeah, because there are some artists who are just, there are some people who do crowd
work. Russell Peters, they are incredible. Incredible.
Risk. You take more risks or less risks?
More risk.
Prefer a tight five or a new five?
New five.
Applause or laughter?
Laughter.
Truth or exaggeration?
Exaggeration. I'm a comedian.
The early show or the late show?
The late show.
Open strong or close strong?
Close strong.
Last one, comedy in one word.
Comedy in one word. Can I say more than one word?
Yeah, of course you can, man.
Okay, this is reading a book written by a friend of mine, Adam Bloom, and there's a quote there that comedy is it's a funny person doing material. Not a person doing funny material. I think it was Woody Allen who said that. So that's my...
What a beautiful way to end the podcast. Hassan, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And I know that our audience is going to really appreciate it too. All of Hassan's future shows that are booked are going to be in the show notes, as well as his Instagram, his LinkedIn. And we're also going to put in... Ole Labib's Instagram in the show notes too, because we always want to support Sudanese artists. Thank you so much, Hassan.
Thank you, Abdulaziz. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Before you go, I just want 30 more seconds of your time. Firstly, thank you for taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please do take a moment to leave us a review. It really helps getting exposure to the podcast for other people. We only do this stuff for you, so please do take a moment to leave a review. If you are interested in our digital marketing agency, Kush Digital, you can go to cush.digital and hit the contact form and we'll get right back to you. The Impact Lab has a free course on the website called
the prompt monkey problem. So if you think that you are in that category of people who are using AI too much and not necessarily building foundational skills or foundational knowledge, go to the impactlab.store and you can sign up for the course entirely free, no catch, no credit card, nothing. Just jump in, do the course, get your certificate, and then start building your own foundational knowledge in marketing. Thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to seeing you at the next episode.